From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our series on cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds. First from the archive, an interview with the late poet Allen Ginsberg, a hero to several generations. He was one of the most important beat poets of the 50s, an icon of the 60s counterculture, and a father figure to the performance poets of the 90s. Then we'll hear from painter Chuck Close. For over 30 years, he's painted his larger-than-life close-ups of faces, which show every wrinkle and every pore. Last year, his work was the subject of a major retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Indonesian legislature has voted to support the independence of East Timor and to reject the presidency of B.J. Habibie. The presidential election is scheduled to take place on Wednesday in Indonesia. Today's vote gives a strong boost to Habibie's main rival, Megawati Sukarnoputri. NPR's Eric Weiner is in Jakarta. He says the rejection of Habibie was not unexpected.
Nobody was really sure going into this exactly what the outcome of the vote would be. It's no surprise in the sense that people here have been openly criticizing President B.J. Habibie's policies for some time. In fact, some people are surprised by the fact that this vote was in fact so close, 355 to 322. So it was a bit closer than expected, but clearly a setback for President B.J. Habibie's chances of holding on to power.
Tomorrow's presidential vote is the first openly contested presidential race in the country's history. There's new information about the mysterious ailment known as Gulf War Syndrome. A RAND Corporation study says a drug known as PB that was given to troops needs further study. The report says the drug cannot be ruled out as a possible cause of the illness. Republican leaders from Congress are sitting down with President Clinton at the White House, but neither side is predicting a budget agreement to emerge right away, so the Senate joined the House in approving a temporary spending measure while the budget talks continue. A modest report on inflation today helped the stock market shed some of its inflation jitters. NPR's John Itzde reports.
Government data showed consumer prices rising 0.4% in September. That's what analysts had expected. Stock investors who were stunned by a bad wholesale inflation report last week heaved a sigh of relief and sent the Dow Industrials up 219 points in early trading. The Dow ended the day up more than 88 points. Bond investors were initially relieved too, but later sent interest rates up after focusing on the fact that September inflation was higher than the average for recent months. In fact, the Consumer Price Index is up 2.6% for the past 12 months. That's above the Federal Reserve's forecast for inflation this year. Many economists still expect the Fed to raise rates a quarter of a point at their next meeting in mid-November to keep inflation in check. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
One of the nation's most prominent computer retailers is taking steps to mend fences with black consumers. CompUSA announced today that it will advertise with black-oriented media. And the company's head says he'll also hire a black-owned ad agency and offer discounts to consumers who'd been involved in a protest. The announcement follows a 10-week campaign spearheaded by radio talk show host Tom Joyner and black entertainment television commentator Tavis Smiley. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Israeli officials today expressed hope that Congress will change its mind and appropriate money promised for Middle East peace efforts. The first installment of a total $1.9 billion was not included in the foreign aid bill vetoed by President Clinton. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
However cynical, it's become a fact of peacemaking here that every concession must be coaxed with financial reward. Israel's deputy defense minister flew to Washington last week to lobby Congress. Critics have accused Prime Minister Ehud Barak of failing to do enough of the same. Today, Israel's foreign minister blamed Congress's decision on election year politics. The deputy defense minister says he's received high-level assurances Congress will change its mind. President Clinton promised the money as part of last year's U.S.-sponsored Y Plantation peace deal. Israel has the most at stake, $1.2 billion to pay for pulling troops out of the West Bank, defense equipment, and better intelligence. The Palestinians are to receive $400 million in economic aid, and Jordan, $300 million. Jennifer Lutton, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Several thousand French high school students have been demonstrating in Paris and three other cities today. They're demanding smaller classes and better funding. It's the third time students have taken to the streets since the school year began in September. As of today, you can access the entire Encyclopedia Britannica on the Internet for free. The company first put the encyclopedia online 5 years ago, but charged users $85 a year. Now Britannica is dropping the online charge and will try to earn revenue through advertising. On Wall Street, stock prices were higher. The Dow was up 88 points. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. From Perseus Books, publisher of The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, the best short works of Richard Feynman, with an introduction by Freeman Dyson. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're presenting a series of interviews with cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds. The late Allen Ginsberg was a cultural hero to several generations. He was one of the leading beat poets in the 50s. In the 60s, he was a cultural icon of the counterculture. Through the 70s and 80s, he continued to write and to explore Eastern religions. By the 90s, he was an inspiration to up-and-coming performance poets. Allen Ginsberg died of liver cancer in 1997, at the age of 70. His work is being revived in several forms. A new book about him called Screaming with Joy has just been published. Archive footage of him is featured in the documentary about beat writers, The Source. And several collections of his poems and essays will be published over the next few months. We're going to hear an interview I recorded with Allen Ginsberg in 1994. Let's start with an excerpt of his 1956 recording of his now classic poem, Howl.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves to the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz.
Hal was partly inspired by Allen Ginsberg's mother, who had been in a mental hospital.
She had been there for several years, and I had put her there after a breakthrough of sort of very violent behavior toward her sister and a cousin she was staying with. And then I had gone out to San Francisco, but the grief was very much on my mind. I had a friend, Carl Seldman, with whom I had been in a mental hospital 6 years before, and he was back also in Pilgrim State too. So I addressed the poem ostensibly to him, but the emotions were, I think, directed toward my mother, both grief and a sense of solidarity.
Yeah, you know, part one begins with one of your most famous lines.
Yeah.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness.
Starving, hysterical, naked. The original phrase was starving, mystical, naked, but I figured that was a little bit too simple-minded, because the problem was not all the problem of society. It was also the neurosis of the people. So there's a certain ironic edge to it, which I don't think critics at the time realized. I said starving, hysterical, naked. So it wasn't just a one-dimensional protest for the safety of madmen. It was also like trying to give a quick sketches of a series of cases that I drew from real life.
Now I want to move on to another poem, America.
Yeah.
It was read the same night as Howl.
Yes, and that's the very first unveiling of that poem. It's really funny. The text in the recording differs a little from the final text that I wound up with.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few extra, some very funny lines, actually.
Yeah, it really is very funny, and you get a lot of laughs from the audience.
Well, it sounds like a stand-up comedy routine. That's the era, actually, of Lenny Bruce around San Francisco. He was playing, I think, at the Purple Onion, and I went down to see him and watch his act, actually. But I hadn't expected that kind of reaction. And I didn't think the poem was that good, nor did Kerouac. It was just sort of like a joke, you know, like a takeoff, send-up of America, very lighthearted. But it's done with many different voices in a kind of schizophrenic persona. You know, 1 minute serious, 1 minute faggoty, 1 minute desperate, 1 minute religious, 1 minute patriotic, 1 minute I'm putting my queer shoulder to the wheel.
Why don't we hear the beginning of America as you read it in 1956 at Town Hall in Berkeley.
America, I've given you all, and now I'm nothing. America, $2.27, January 17th, 1956. America, I can't stand my own mind. America, when will we end the human war? Go f*** yourself with your atom bomb. I don't feel good. Don't bother me. I won't write my poem until I'm in my right mind. When will you be angelic? When will you take off your clothes? When will you look at yourself through the grave? When will you be worthy of your million Christs? America, why are your libraries full of tears? America, when will you send your eggs to India? I'm sick of your insane demands. When will you reinvent the heart? When will you manufacture lambs? When will your cowboys reach Spangler? When will your dams release the flood of eastern tears? When will your technicians get drunk and abolish money? When will you institute religions of perception in your legislatures? When can I go into the supermarket and buy what I need with my good looks? America, after all, it is you and I who are perfect, not the next world. Your machinery is too much for me. I don't want to work for a living. You made me want to be a saint. There must be some other way to settle this argument.
You know, you must have seen yourself as a provocateur in a way at a very young age. I'm thinking, you know, that you were just coming from a place that was not average. You know, your mother was mentally ill. Your
right.
mother had been a communist. You were gay. You were an intellectual. You loved poetry. I mean,
but
just
also
everything about your life kind of set you apart.
But you've got to realize, by this time, I had already known William Burroughs and Jack Kerouac 12 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is not, you know, some sudden discovery of a community or ideas. We had a long period of privacy and silence to ripen our art, to know each other and to amuse each other and to understand each other's language and intelligence and sort of enlarge our own consciousness with the experience of others. Also, I'd already had some sort of natural religious experience, and we had all by this time tried out some of the psychedelic drugs in addition, on top of a natural religious experience that was without drugs. And already had traveled a bit, and so we were, I wasn't a young kid then, I was 28 years old. You know, it was quite a ripe time.
Was it surprising to you to find people like Burroughs and Kerouac, who you felt this kind of friendship and aesthetic closeness with?
No, it was just some sort of natural kinship that we felt almost instantly on meeting.
But did you expect you'd ever find that?
Not exactly, but I hadn't even conceived of such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I conceived of friends, and I'd had friends in high school, but I was still in the closet. Kerouac was the first person I was able to come out of the closet to and tell him about it, and actually slept with him once or twice, though he was primarily straight. But he was very tender toward me, and he saw that I was in solitary and in a great deal of confusion and anguish, and he took a sort of kindly view. Burroughs was always brought out front and clear and lucid and intelligent as he is now. At the age of 80, he was so. At the age of 34, I think he was then. So I was lucky when I was 17 that I met people whose genius sort of ignited my own talents to, and sort of upgraded, I think, my own natural intelligence. But I'm really a student of Kerouac and of Burroughs, and in some respects an imitator. I've had a steadier life, and so I'm perhaps more on the scene as now, on the air, or going around giving readings, but I feel myself basically a pupil of Kerouac's ear and his intelligence and language and his awareness of the pronunciation of consonants.
Well, when you talk about being a student of Kerouac's, I've never been able to tell how much your style of reading influenced him and how much his style of reading influenced you.
Oh, I think his style influenced me. It was way back in 47, 48, I heard him read Shakespeare aloud. And it was such an interesting intonation that he put into a soliloquy of Hamlet, I think, where Hamlet is sitting down on the steps saying, what am I, what am I doing? Am I nothing but a John of Dreams? And the way Kerouac said, a John of Dreams, it was like his mind went off into a little dream at it in that phrase. So I began seeing that there were intonations, differences of pitch possible. You know, most poetry still is pronounced in a monotone or a duotone, it's like I'm talking now in a sort of monotone. But there are possibilities in conversation where you go from, a little high woodle when you're talking to a little baby to down to very serious heart tones when you're talking to your grandmother and on her last days on earth.
Of course, with your readings, I always felt that there was a certain Hebraic intonation, even though I know that, Buddhism was probably an even greater influence on you, and you certainly hear that in your voice, too, but there is that kind of Hebraic
The Hebraic
sound.
Thing is very real. Mm-hmm. My grandfathers were rabbis, and one of the most strong musical influence I ever had was the hearing of a recording of Sophie Breslau, a great operatic singer, singing Eli Eli, with a kind of melismus, I guess you'd call it, sort of a very beautiful way of bending the notes that's characteristic of Hebrew melody.
Now, when did that start to enter your reading style?
Well, certainly with Kaddish, because I was imitating the davening motion of Kaddish with the sound of Yishkedal, Yishkedaz, Yishalei, Yishalov, Made Kushu, Bukhu. Da-da-da, 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 magnificent, mourn no more, mart of heart, mind behind, married dream, mortal changed. Hmm. That is the whole rhythm of the poem has a kind of combination of Ray Charles, I Got a Woman, Yes Indeed, Yes Indeed, Yes Indeed, and which I'd been hearing the morning before I wrote the poem, and a rhythm of the original Hebrew Kaddish that was still running through my mind and body. For the first time I'd heard it, actually. A Jewish friend played it to me in dawn light the morning that I started writing the poem.
And the Kaddish is the Hebrew prayer for the dead.
Yes, it's a kind of a mass or a prayer for the dead done in the synagogue when you have a minyan or a group of elders that can get together to help you mourn for the dead.
So I guess you didn't say the prayer when your mother died.
Well, I didn't know it as well, but I did try and do it. Actually, I wandered around San Francisco with Jack Kerouac and Philip Whalen, and we went into various synagogues, but there was no minyan, so that we couldn't do it. So this is a way of making up about a couple years later.
And this is a couple of years after your mother, Naomi,
yeah, my mother died in
55.
Incidentally, I sent her the original, a copy of the original manuscript of Howl, which she received about a week before she died, and she wrote me a letter which was postmarked the day she died, which is quoted in Kaddish, in which she said she got my poems. She can't tell whether it's good or bad. My father should judge because he's a poet, but judging from the... she'd read it up, and she said, well, get married, Alan, don't take drugs. And she said, I have the key. The key is in the window. The key is in the sunlight in the window. And then she died of stroke, I think, perhaps hours or within 24 hours of writing the letter. So I received that letter after I had heard that she died.
Huh.
So it was like a message from the land of the dead, so to speak.
Allen Ginsberg recorded in 1994. He died in 1997 of liver cancer at the age of 70. This is Fresh Air. One of the advantages of being on the air for many years is that we've developed an archive of interviews with many of the most interesting writers, artists, and performers of our time. It's your support that has made our show possible and your support that will keep it going. Please call with a pledge. Thank you. Let's get back to our 1994 interview with poet Allen Ginsberg. He died in 1997.
Now, if you had grandfathers who were rabbis, did you say?
Well, scholars, you know, long guys with big black hats and long bearded, long gray beards, who died of cancer from smoking, actually,
in New York
in the 30s.
How did you get to be in your 20s before you heard the prayer for the dead?
Well, we didn't. My mother was communist and my father was socialist.
So you didn't go to synagogue?
So I did go to synagogue, and I went to Sunday school, or what do you call it, the shul, to learn Hebrew and traditional, prepare for a bar mitzvah, but somehow I asked questions that were resented by the rabbi, and I got kicked out when I was about 8 years old or nine. And I never did understand it, because I thought I was just sort of talking intelligently to him and quiet inquiring, that there must have been an edge of skepticism to it. But there was no tolerance for that at all. Mm. My questions weren't answered, and I was just told to get out. So I've never had very much of a classical Hebrew education.
Your mother was institutionalized several times.
Many, many times. All during my childhood, I had to go out to visit her in Greystone Hospital.
Were you frightened by her madness?
Sometimes sorrowed, sometimes frightened, sometimes stuck with a responsibility I couldn't carry out as a kid, going out alone to see her in a mental hospital when I was 12, 13, 14. Or having to stay home and take care of her while my father was in school teaching, and getting into crisis situations with her that I couldn't handle, actually. It kind of broke my brain in a way, broke my spirit to some extent.
No, when you started doing hallucinogenics, like LSD, did your hallucinations ever scare you because you'd seen your mother have hallucinations and delusions because of her mental illness?
Well, no, not really. I realized that if everybody began disagreeing with me, I better look around twice and think three times and be pretty sure I knew what I was doing. And so I've been able to be in situations where everybody disagreed. But at the same time maintain my sanity, so to speak, by simply following my heart, really. I have as much a tendency to paranoia as anybody in the United States at this point, but at least I can see it's paranoia, and most people don't see their own paranoia.
That's interesting. So your mother's delusions actually helped you figure out what was real and what wasn't?
Well, I went through the... I sort of went through the mill already, so I was kind of inoculated. I would say that the experience of having to deal with somebody who was sort of deluded and hallucinating, also voices and all, helped me deal with my own psychic disturbances and also with the psychic disturbances of other people. I seem to have a kind of tolerance that, you know, in one ear, out the other, or, so that I can be with people who are quite disturbed, get disturbed myself, but not so much so that I have to turn my back until, you know, all hope is lost.
Where were you in your performance style in 1964, the year that the recording of Kaddish was made?
I hadn't ever tried to read anything as long as Kaddish, complete. And so there, and I had drunk a little bit, not very much, so I wasn't really drunk, but I was sort of a little keyed up with alcohol so that I was able to loosen my feelings quite a bit. So the only problem there is maintaining control of feelings and not breaking up and crying in the middle of the more moving passages.
Is there a particular section of Kaddish that you've had the most problem with controlling your emotion?
Yeah, there's a section that begins when I'm visiting my mother in the mental hospital for the last time, and I walk in and I see she's had a stroke, and then there suddenly there's a break in the poem, and there's a kind of lyrical rhapsody. Communist beauty, sit here married in the summer among daisies promised. Happiness at hand. To the section that ends, oh, beautiful garble of my karma. It's really a nice, exquisite, poetic passage, but it's also full of feeling, and it's like a flashback in the midst of tragedy to a happier day. And so there's a lot of emotion buried there from childhood. Also, at the very end, the section, oh, mother, what have I left out? Oh, mother, what have I forgotten? With your eyes, with your death full of flowers. That has a sort of cumulative emotional buildup that's quite great.
Why don't I play an excerpt of Kaddish? And you wrote this in the late 1950s. The recording we're going to hear from you, Neubach, set was made at Brandeis University in 1964.
With your eyes running naked out of the apartment, screaming into the hall, with your eyes being led away by policemen to an ambulance, with your eyes strapped down on an operating table, with your eyes with a pancreas removed, with your eyes of appendix operation, with your eyes of abortion, with your eyes of ovaries removed, with your eyes of shock, with your eyes of lobotomy, with your eyes of divorce, with your eyes of stroke, with your eyes alone, with your eyes, with your eyes, with your death full of flowers.
That's Allen Ginsberg reading an excerpt of Kaddish. It's included on his new box set, Holy Soul, Jelly Roll. Tell us just a little bit about what your life is like now.
Well, I have a little heart trouble and diabetes, but I travel a bit still, and I write quite a bit, and I'm doing a lot of photography and put out several books of photos. And so this year I think I'll do some doodles and have them sort of start drawing. So, you know, just enjoying myself at the age of 68, extending my activities in various directions, but focused primarily on writing and on poetry. With the idea that candor ends paranoia. If I can make my own mind transparent so that people know what I'm really thinking, they don't have anything to be scared of, and they can use it as a mirror for their own minds.
Allen Ginsberg recorded in 1994. He died in 1997 of liver cancer at the age of 70. Several new collections of his poems and essays will be published over the next few months, and there's a new book about him called Screaming with Joy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, painter Chuck Close on why no subject interests him more than the human face, and why he paints 9-foot hyper-realist portraits that reveal every facial pore and wrinkle. Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delta Books, publisher of Ithaca, A Daughter's Memoir of Being Found by Sarah Safian, the story of an adopted woman who was located by her birth parents. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our faces reveal so much about who we are. That's part of what makes Chuck Close's paintings so fascinating. They offer you the chance to stare at larger-than-life, hyper-realist renderings of faces, faces that become transformed into what Time magazine art critic Robert Hughes described as moonscapes of pores, wrinkles, blackheads, and stubble. Chuck Close doesn't paint with big, elaborate brushstrokes. His faces are composed of little dots, circles, and squiggles. It's the accumulation of these markings that add up to the larger image of the face. Chuck Close has been painting faces since the 60s. It's amazing that he can paint at all now. Nearly 10 years ago, a stroke left him paralyzed from the neck down. After a partial recovery, he's been able to paint from his wheelchair. I spoke with him last year, after the opening of a retrospective of his work at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I asked Chuck Close why the face has been his subject for so long.
Well, initially I started making portraits, or at that time I didn't even call them portraits, I called them heads, because it was as different as possible from what I had been doing before. My work had been abstract, and I was looking for something that was diametrically opposed to what I had done as a student. And so the first heads were just my friends, and I had no idea then, 30 years ago, that I would still be painting heads today. And in fact, I'm sure I wouldn't have believed it if somebody had predicted it. But over the years, I found that of all the kinds of subject matter that I could use, nothing interests me as much as people. And it offers the viewer an entrance into the work through a life experience, because we all look in mirrors and look at each other and look at images in magazines and film. And it's a great leveler, whether a person is the most sophisticated person in the art world or a lay person. We all share that knowledge of and interest in the way people look.
I want to talk a little bit more about the faces themselves, the way you paint the faces themselves. You've said that you tried to see the faces neutrally, without opinion or subjectivity, without editorializing in any way about the face. And yet, the face always reads in some way to me. I see the faces very subjectively, even though you as the painter didn't see them subjectively. Talk with me about the approach that you're taking toward the subject matter, of not kind of imposing any kind of feeling or point of view.
Well, it's not that I'm uninterested in the psychological reading of the paintings. I just don't want to lobby for one reading over all others. And to present them straightforwardly and flat-footedly without editorial comment, without cranking it up for extra psychological readings, or without drawing big circles around things saying, make sure you see it this way. I sort of leave it to the viewer to read the image. And I believe that a person's face is a kind of roadmap to their life. And embedded in the imagery is a great deal of evidence if you want to decode it. If a person has laughed his or her whole life, they'll have laugh lines. If they frown their whole lives, they have furrows in their brow. And it's not necessary for me to have them laughing or crying or anything in order to have people be able to read them.
Your canvases are very large, and because you include every detail of a person's face,
every line and wrinkle and pucker and pore. Every flaw is included, or what we would consider a flaw is not only included, but it's kind of enlarged because the painting is so large. And that's part of what I find so fascinating. The faces are so real and recognizable. Looking at one of your faces in a painting, it's a lot like looking at yourself in the bathroom mirror with the kind of harsh lighting that you have there, and you see everything. So there's something so recognizable about the landscape of the faces, the way you paint them.
Yeah, I we don't stand close enough to each other. We don't invade each other's space enough to really be able to see the intimate level of detail that I typically put in one of these paintings, because they're in fact usually 9 feet high. So if there's more information than you ever really wanted to know about someone, and it makes it perhaps a more intimate experience. I make try to make these big, aggressive, confrontational images that you can see from clear across the room, and you have one kind of relationship with it there, and then another relationship at a middle viewing distance where you scan it and you can't readily see the thing as a whole. And then hopefully I've sucked the viewer right up to the canvas where you can see the individual marks and the methodology, how it got there.
Tell us a little bit about the way you work with grids when you're painting a face from a photograph.
Mm-hmm. Well, grids, you know, besides being one of the great modernist conventions, the grid has been around most recently because it's a flattening device. It's a way to, to restate the flatness of the canvas. But in fact, the use of a grid as a scaling up method goes back to ancient Egypt and was, of course, used in the Renaissance and used all along as a way to take a small drawing or a preparatory sketch and enlarge it by having smaller squares on the preparatory sketch and bigger ones on the painting. It's just a way to scale up an image. But and all of my work from the 1960s on have been built with the use of a grid. I don't use a projector or anything like that to get an image on. But at a certain point, I decided to let the grid remain a visible part of the image. Initially, I would get rid of the grid so nobody knew that I used it. But at a certain point, I began to leave the incremental unit to show. And I found all kinds of ways, from using my own fingerprints to gluing on little wads of pulp paper to any one of a number of ways of working incrementally and letting the individual unit show. One of the things I like about working that way is that there's nothing about the building block which says anything about what's going to be made from it.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's no mark that equals hair. There's no mark that equals skin or anything else. It's a little bit like an architect choosing a brick. The brick doesn't determine anything about what kind of building will be built from it. You stack up the bricks one way and you make a gas station, or you stack up the bricks another way and you can build a cathedral. Both of them will be very different experiences, but it wasn't the brick that determined the nature of that experience.
So what suits your personality about working in these smaller units, one dot at a time or one grid at a time?
Well, you know, actually, I'm a nervous wreck. I'm a slob. I have no patience, and I'm rather lazy. All of those things would seem to guarantee that I would not make work like I make. But I felt I didn't want to just go with my nature and say, well, that's the way I am. I can only make big, sloppy, nervous, quick paintings. I thought to construct a situation in which I couldn't behave that way was also to address my nature. But I found that one of the nice things about working this way, working incrementally, is that I don't have to reinvent the wheel every single day. Today I did what I did yesterday, and tomorrow I'll do what I do today. You can pick it up and put it down. I don't have to wait for inspiration. There are no good days or bad days. And I'm every day essentially builds positively on what I did the day before. In some ways, I think it's rather like what used to be called women's work, that is quilting, crocheting, knitting, or whatever. And the advantage of that way of working was that women could knit for a while, put it down, go feed the baby, come back and pick it up and knit a little more, and then put it down and go out and weed the garden. And it allowed for a way to just keep working. If a belief in a process, for instance, how do you make a sweater? Oh my God, I wouldn't know how to make a sweater. But if you believe in the process and you knit one and you purl two long enough, eventually you get a sweater. And I think, given my nature, it was very good for me to have a way to work in which I was able to add to what I already had and slowly construct the final image out of these little building blocks.
How have you dealt with impatience, though? Don't you ever feel like, okay, it's going to take me another 12 months of these dots to have a painting? I want to see it now.
Well, you know, that's I do finish each area as I go, so I have a chance to see what it's going to look like almost from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, patience is a funny thing. I used to work every day and make a painting every day, and now I work every day and I make a painting every several months. But work is work. And it doesn't seem to take any more patience to keep working on one piece than it did to make a different piece every day. And the big difference is that I used to enjoy painting. I loved the activity, but I didn't care very much about what I made. And now I have a way of working which... like I say, is essentially a positive building on what I already have, and eventually I get to something about which I care a great deal more. So for me, that was a very productive trade-off.
My guest is painter Chuck Close. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is painter Chuck Close. We're going to hear about a medical condition that transformed his life and nearly ended his career. It was, I think, 10 years ago that you had a terrible medical problem. I think it was a blood vessel in your spinal cord that broke?
And well, actually, it's very funny that I don't know that your listening audience knows that you're in Philadelphia and I'm in New York. And I'm staring at a microphone instead of staring at you.
Mm-hmm.
But it is it was 9 years ago that I was in this very studio talking to Susan Stamberg about the National Endowment for the Arts, which was the last thing I did before I went up to Gracie Mansion, where I, in fact, suffered this collapsed spinal artery. And became within a matter of a few minutes a quadriplegic. So it's a little freaky to be in this studio, and I'm sort of wondering about what's going to happen today when I leave. But at any rate, yes, I did have this event in my life in which I ultimately became a what's called an incomplete quadriplegic. I was initially paralyzed from the shoulders down, but I got considerable return. I don't have the, I am confined to a wheelchair, and I don't have the use of my my hands. And I paint now with brushes strapped to a brace, which is strapped to my arm. But essentially, I'm not doing anything that I don't think I would have been doing anyway. I think the work has progressed much the same way that it would have. And luckily, I had something to get back to that really mattered to me. If I hadn't already known how to paint, I don't think I could have learned to do it post-injury. But once you know how to do something, it's not so hard to equip yourself with what's necessary to be able to get back to it.
Because you don't have much movement now at all, and you have to paint with the brushes strapped onto your wrist, have you given a lot of thought to how much painting is something that happens in your mind and how much is something that happens with your hands?
Well, somebody told me in the hospital, and I don't remember who it is, that, oh, you'll be all right because you paint with your head and not with your hands. And I thought, oh, easy for you to say. You know? I thought, gee, this is like something came out of a fortune cookie or something. I was actually quite quite annoyed that they had this this kind of throwaway answer for my very severe problem. But in fact, you know they were right. Once you know what art looks like, you can figure out how to make some of it. And it's just a question of adaptation. I would like to say also that that part of my ability to get back to work is largely due to the fact that I am and have been for 30 years a very successful artist and have made a lot of money, and I can afford to equip myself with what's necessary to be able to get back to work. I can have a totally wheelchair-accessible studio. I can hire assistants who can get me where I want to go. And I still make the paintings entirely by myself. My assistants don't help me paint, but they help me with all the other things. So if this were to happen to another artist who was not as recognized and celebrated as I was and not as financially successful as I was, no matter how much they might have wished to get back to work, it may have been an impossibility. So again, I think that I'm very lucky.
If you don't mind my asking, I know, you know, often when people lose the ability to move, it's through a traumatic accident, a car crash, or you know, some kind of terrible injury, a fall. Mm-hmm. But for you, it was a broken artery.
And I just sort of collapsed. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So when did you realize that you had lost movement? Did you awaken from a coma, or was this something that came on gradually?
Well, I had tremendous pain, and I had the pain over the years. It would come and go, and nobody could ever figure out what it was. And this time, the pain ended up. I had sort of massive seizures all over my body, and then. All of a sudden, my whole body just was still. And we couldn't figure out what happened. Actually, it took them several days to figure out what happened to me. I remember my art dealer came in and he said, come on, get out of bed. He was convinced that I had some sort of hysterical paralysis. It took a while for everyone to figure out what, in fact, did happen.
How did you come up with a system that worked for getting your paintbrush attached to your arm in such a way that you could get the kind of mobility and control that you needed?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was in a rehabilitation hospital After a couple of months of being in intensive care and stuff, I was moved to the rehabilitation hospital that was connected to the hospital I was in. And I began rehab. And I remember rolling down the hall one day and seeing the name on a door. It said occupational therapy. I said, oh, great, they'll help me get back to my occupation. But in fact, it was much more about stacking spools and making things out of pipe cleaners. I must say that the therapists were wonderful people and very helpful, but it took the active intervention of my wife, who really went to bat for me and made sure they understood just how important it was for me and my sanity to be able to get back to work. And she convinced the therapist to stop trying to convince me how to do things that I didn't need to do, and to get back to what really mattered. And they found me a space in the basement of the building, and I equipped it as a studio and managed to start painting while I was still in rehabilitation.
Were there times when you found yourself trying to make things out of pipe cleaners? And I mean, because that's what you were supposed to be doing in occupational therapy.
Well, you know, they tried to get me to do my laundry. I said, well, you know, I didn't do my laundry before. Why should I want to do my laundry now? And they tried to show me how to, you know, use a computer. And I said, I have absolutely no interest in using a computer. And I really don't want to do it with a pencil stuck in my teeth. It was a fight because they're trying to bring everybody along, and they have a kind of general attitude towards what's liable to be helpful in a person's life. And I was looking for very specific kinds of help.
Painter Chuck Close recorded last year. This is Fresh Air. On Fresh Air, we ask our guests to reflect out loud about their work and their lives, and we try to keep the conversations as direct and informal as we can. Because radio is so portable, Chuck Close and all our guests can keep you company in the car, at home, or at work. Speaking of work, I had one job after college in which the only thing that rescued me from complete alienation was being able to listen to an afternoon show on public radio that featured interviews as well as blues and jazz recordings. Fresh Air is here only because it's supported by its listeners. It's time to ask you again for that support. Thank you. Let's get back to our interview with painter Chuck Close, recorded last year at the time of his retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I want to say something else and get you to say something else about the current style that you're painting in. Your current painting style now is this really interesting mix of abstraction and representational painting. You know, because what you're doing now, as we talked about, you know, your paintings are based on a series of grids. And in each grid is like a little abstract painting. Each grid is, you know, is some circles of color or squares of color or squiggles of color. And this little abstract grid, when taken in the context of all the other little abstract grids, forms a face. Mm-hmm. But the faces have become more abstract than they used to be. They're not so much about finding every follicle, every pore.
Well, it's probably lucky that as I age and all of my friends age, that I've adopted a kinder, gentler strategy to painting, because I was in my 20s when I started, and we weren't as wrinkled and there wasn't as much surface incident in people's faces, and so right now it's probably a good thing that a lot of that surface information isn't showing up, but one of the things I get to finish one of those little paintings, one of those little abstract paintings, all the time, several a day or a whole bunch of them in a day. So I get a little piece of pleasure over and over and over, and a little piece of completion over and over. And that's one of the really wonderful things about the way I work. But, you know, I didn't start making representational imagery because I was against abstraction. As a matter of fact, my favorite work was usually abstract, often very minimal, and often sculpture.
Don't you feel like you found a way to combine all of those instincts into one canvas?
That's one of the nice things about it. You know, I was a big, big fan as a student of de Kooning, who I still consider the greatest American artist of the 20th century. And I loved him so much, and I was I painted way more than my share of de Kooning's. In fact, when I met de Kooning late in life, I said it's very nice. Late in his life, I said it's very nice to meet somebody who's painted more de Kooning's than I have. But one of the problems with being a good student, and I was a good student, was that I knew what art looked like, and I could demonstrate that I knew what it looked like. But it must look like someone else's art, or it wouldn't look like art. And one of the wonderful things about having purged my work of all those influences, and driving myself into my own idiosyncratic corner where no one else's answers would fit the question that I was asking myself, was that ultimately, over the years, I found a way to get a lot of that de Kooning color and some of the marks and things that I love so much back into my work. But now I get to use de Kooning color and make a Chuck Close instead of using de Kooning color and making a de Kooning.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, something that's interesting about the current series of paintings, or at least the latest series of paintings on exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art, because it's a kind of figurative painting of a face, you know, representational painting, but it's comprised of these little abstract paintings, these little grids of abstract paintings. There's this dynamism, there's the sense of like movement and pulsing energy that the paintings have, because if at most distances from the painting, this now you actually see the different components, and they just kind of pulse a little bit. So mm-hmm. there's this energy.
It's a very elusive image. It keeps shifting on you. As soon mm-hmm. as you try, you see, oh, that looks like an eye. So if you look at it, all of a sudden it decomposes into its various incremental marks and stops being an eye. So it requires the active participation of the viewer, which is one of the things that I like about the way I work. There's a real kind of physicality to it, and both in the building of the painting, and also I think an active role for the viewer. You know, when an artist goes into the studio, there's a kind of ritual performance that the artist performs in the studio, but no one is there to watch it. The painting is really the evidence that ritual dance or performance took place. But I think there's an opportunity for the viewer, if the viewer can get in sync with the work, they can vicariously experience some of the things that the artist was going through and sort of re-experience the performance itself.
Chuck Close, recorded last year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. I'm Terry Gross, and this is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, our series on cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds continues. We'll hear from one of the originators of hard-boiled fiction, Mickey Spillane, and one of the greatest British mystery writers, P.D. James. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.